is the Next Trip Podcast with aviation insiders Doug and Drew. Together, with more than 40 years of industry experience, they are creating a network for other av geeks and travel enthusiasts to obsess about all things aviation. All thoughts and opinions are their own.
Good day and welcome to Boarding Pass 228, operating on April 8th, 2024. This is Doug, an airline pilot, and I'm here with my buddy Drew, an airline ops manager and private pilot trainee. We're here to discuss aviation topics from an industry insider's perspective. Happy solar eclipse day, everyone. Hopefully some of you are able to see it. Unfortunately, I'll be sitting on a tropical volcanic rock in the middle of the Pacific in a place where we won't even get 1% coverage, but I'll be in the island, so I can't really complain. Drew, you're home now, it looks like. Last we spoke, you were hoping to get your mom as far as Hong Kong on her way to Sri Lanka. How did that turn out?
It turned out great, but before that, no one is going to be shedding a tear for you, Doug. You're going to be in Maui having your sad cocktail in front of, I don't know what the mountain is there, but it's beautiful scenery and you'll be fine. Shout out to Greg, who will be in the line because he's in Cincinnati or close to the line. Patrick, our buddy, is going to visit Beryl in Dallas, which is also on the line. So our friends can...
Yeah, and Nate will be there too.
Oh, Nate, right, because Nate lives there.
In Dallas, yeah. Nate will see it before Greg will.
That's true. Okay, so we can live vicariously through them, and we're going to miss the thing. But our buddy Aaron, he always goes to these. So I still don't know if he's going to Texas or Mexico. I'm pretty sure it's Mexico. He'll tell us all about it, along with 20 corrections to to the episode. We got a lot to cover, but speaking of Aaron and you, I used the term oligarchs for Boeing and Airbus the week before.
Sergey, yeah, the gold medallion, hairy chest, yes, on his yacht.
And that is the example. I did not make a mistake. I meant to represent them as oligarchs because they're the fat, old, lazy people with the gold chains around their necks and way too rich, right? And they are on oligopoly, right, which is the proper definition, but I am describing them as oligarchs because they're like the kings of the industry, right? And even
I've never heard a company called that, but it's funny. Yeah, you are completely correct in your assessment.
Well, Dima, who sent a letter to us, he's in San Diego. He called Boeing the patriarch. Airbus might actually be the patriarch.
Okay, at one point, yes, they were the patriarch. When I hear patriarch, I think stately. I think professional. I think that grandpa who you love going to their house and they're always just very formal. Boeing, I think, has lost that patriarch status.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's more like drunk uncle now, I would say. Yeah. I'm kidding. You know, we give Boeing a lot of pressure and a lot of jibes because we love them. We love Boeing. We want Boeing to improve, and we're on Boeing's side, right? Our favorite planes are Boeing. We love the 747, the 57, the 777, which you fly, Doug. So don't get us wrong. This is not a anti-Boeing podcast in any way. We have to talk about something that's ongoing as we speak. There was a 4.8 earthquake centered in Lebanon, New Jersey. I don't know exactly where that is, but it was large enough to close the Newark Tower and to close Kennedy for traffic. Kennedy is now open to traffic. Newark has departures, but Doug, I was telling you, some of the FAA tower guys have moved, and gals have moved into our operations tower at the SFC. So it's nice to be able to help. And I think I told you, Pete, you can thank us when you can, but you're welcome to use our tower. Let's talk about my Hong Kong trip. Feel free to ask me questions because I'm talking a lot, and feel free to stop me and just have a timer and be like, all right, time's up. But we'll do this in fast forward because there's a lot of stuff I want to tell you and the listeners because we're aviation. We're also travel podcast, right? So we talk about travel a lot. So I was in Seattle for the last episode, got to SFO with no issues. Met my mom there, and my mom's at the gate. I wanted to take her to the club. We still had half an hour, and she's like, no, let's just wait here. And I'm like, but she's right. We would go to the club for like 15 minutes and have to go back to the gate. No club, no plantation club at SFO for us.
Even though it's right there. It literally is right above your gate.
Yeah. And I think, you know, this is where my mom might be an avgee because she preferred to just sit and... We were looking at an ANA 777 loading at the gate next door, and she was asking me questions. And of course, the time went by really fast. So she was right. Doug, we both got business class seats together.
And that's awesome.
I have not traveled with my mom in probably a couple years, and I haven't taken her on a trip for a while, so this was nice. I wanted everything to be perfect. Get on the flight was great, the food was great, the crew was excellent. It's like 15 hours, Doug. I was expecting this to be like
a 12-hour...
It was a very...
That's a long flight.
Got there, I slept most of it, which is awesome. Got there at 7:20. We got an Uber instead of taking the express train, because there's two of us, and my mom had two bags that she checked. I don't know why she takes all this stuff. She can't say no. People ask for stuff, and then she brings stuff they probably already have over there, like better stuff. Our buddy Ian flies up on a red-eye flight on a regional commuter flight from Singapore to Hong Kong, which, of course, isn't an A350 internationally configured aircraft.
Yeah, of course it is.
So he gets there at 5 o'clock in the morning and then meets us at our room. Doug, we did a four-hour tour, an organized tour, that took us to Lantau Island, close to where the airport is, because I wanted to see the Big Buddha. Mm-hmm. And they also took us to a fishing village called Tai O. So walk around there, see that, and then...
I love those little fishing villages. Hong Kong is one of the most densely packed and populated cities or countries, if you can call it that anymore, in the world. Mm-hmm. Just from a per capita standpoint, based on the square mileage or square kilometers. I love those little fishing villages. You escape the density of the concrete jungle mm-hmm. of the city. You feel like you're in another world, but you're like 20 minutes away from central Hong Kong. It's incredible.
Oh, yeah. It was charming because when you think Hong Kong, you think high rises. You think, you know, people in business suits and all that. And this was nice. It was like real people that are fishing and just nature. It's actually beautiful. Lantau Island. Then we went to the Big Buddha. It was 268 steps. You couldn't see it. There was so much fog, Doug. You could not see it. It was like zero visibility. Ian and I walked up to it, and as you walk up, there's 268 steps. So it takes about 5 minutes to climb those steps. It's not bad. But then it was kind of mystical and beautiful because you're climbing, and then you see the Buddha in the clouds. It's pretty cool. And of course, yeah, that was all fabulous, but the best part of the trip was the cable car back down to the station, because it went through the clouds, you can't see anything, and then you go below the clouds, and right there in front of you is Chep Lap Kop Airport. It was just it was amazing.
I've seen the cable car from the airport several times.
Went back to the hotel. It was actually Ian's birthday that day, so we're also celebrating his birthday. I got some travel suggestions, and then I'm done. The first night we got there, we ate at the restaurant at the Hyatt there. It's in Causeway Bay. Top floor, it's called Cruise. And we just wanted someplace to eat because we were hungry. It was amazing. So it was Chinese food, but it had all kinds of other stuff. We had Chinese food, we had Chinese duck, we had Chinese greens. But we also had Thai beef curry, and we had Indian roti. It was like Hong Kong, because it's mostly Chinese, but it was still so multicultural. Food was delicious. So if you go, put that on your list if you're going to Hong Kong. It's called Cruise. It's on top of the Hyatt on the Hong Kong Island side. And then in the morning, have you seen in Hong Kong, they have these little diners where the locals go?
Mm-hmm.
And they have like macaroni and ham soup. They have something called a pineapple bun. They have custard tarts. You want to go to and milk tea, Hong Kong milk tea. So when you're in Hong Kong,
milk tea is excellent.
It's excellent. It's so strong. It's almost like coffee. We went to this place called Lucky Star. I'm going to put these links to the restaurant and this other place called Lucky Star. So it's like a diner, but it's not too local because the really local places are packed with people screaming at each other like in any big city. This was like between a Denny's and a true Hong Kong diner. So it was... So we had space. We had all the classics, right? It was delicious. It was cheap. And there were locals there. We were, as far as I saw, we were the only foreigners in there. So it is authentic, if you will. All right, one more.
What you need to start doing, and what we need to start doing as the two of us and as a podcast, I've started doing this on my work trips, mm-hmm. or also when we went to Santiago, you can create a map in Google, like a saved map, that you can put any business, you can save it to that particular map. I call it whatever the city name is, Fun, Osaka Fun, Santiago Fun. And anytime I either get a recommendation from someone or it's a place that I go to that I want to recommend to people, I save it to that city file and then it's shareable. So we should start doing that. You could start with Hong Kong. If anyone goes to Santiago, I have about 25 places on there. Of course, Osaka, I was just there. I think we should start doing that, and we can share it with the listeners,
mm-hmm.
and they can give their recommendations too. And that way, when we go to these cities, you and I, we always talk about having a plan. We don't just want to go and roll the dice and say, oh, what are we going to do? We kind of have an itinerary or a plan. We could start doing that.
Oh, let's absolutely do that. All right. So we'll create a map. We'll see how that works. And we'll include our group of friends and contributors. All of you listening, we can all contribute to this because we're not one note. We're AvGeeks. But we are well-rounded people that we don't just go to spot planes. We also take in the culture and the food and everything. And if you're not doing that, please do that. Do not deny yourself the chance of seeing London and Hong Kong, all these beautiful places with so much culture, to spend 2 full days watching airplanes, which is important. Don't get me wrong.
Tyler.
Tyler. Cough. Okay, one last thing and I'm done. When you're there, bring your ATM card. Don't get a lot of money. Get $100 US dollar equivalent at the ATM machine that's at the airport. You will need cash to buy the ticket on the airport express into town. After that, you don't have to get that Oyster card. Because what we found is all the transit, the trams, the MTR within the city, not including the airport express, you just put your Visa card on the reader, and it has to be Visa, and it charges that. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking at my charges from Hong Kong. The tram is like 26 cents.
Yeah.
Get an Oyster card and put $300 and then you're never going to use $200 of it because you might not ever go back to Hong Kong or you're going to forget about it. Just bring your Visa card, take a few dollars out to get from the airport into town and you are good. And that's it. I think that was that's probably more than I expected to take. But
it's fine. No, it's good. All good info. We do have to move on, but real good news today. It's Friday, the first Friday of the new month, and that's when jobs reports usually get released. And I know we've been beating this drum for a couple years now, but recession, what recession?
Yeah,
the economy added more than 100,000 more jobs than what economists were expecting. This whole airline slowing hiring, airlines asking people for unpaid time off, all the naysayers are banging the drum of, oh, the economy is finally bad and it's crashing like we've been predicting. No, it all has to do with deliveries. And I feel like I'm going crazy standing here screaming this, but The economy is humming along. No signs of a slowdown. All these delays and pauses in hiring, it's all related to Boeing. And I hate to come back to this Boeing story, but it just shows how everything is just so interconnected that when one cog breaks or starts to fray, It messes with the entire thing.
Yep. And as far as the delivery is slowing down, to be honest, the airlines have had such a strong and a rapid run-up of people retiring with COVID, right? People leaving, and all these new people, including you, coming into the industry. It is nice to take to put the brakes on a little bit because there's still so much training to do, still so many people in the pipeline that are just coming into their jobs. We want the deliveries to continue and all that, but I'm looking at the positive. It is nice to take a breath and reevaluate and get people through these trainings and not have this everything at breakneck speed. And there's so much green in our industry, not just pilots, people who work in my department. I look around, most of them have been there like a year and a half, if that. Mm-hmm. So they're still getting
back. It's back to normal. It's back to what it was. I know we've talked about this curve, but it was almost exponential above the average for new hires in all departments coming on. It was way above that. Now things are slowing. They're slowing back to the mean. Everything over time, there's a regression to the mean, which means you might have a slowdown and then you catch up, or you might have breakneck growth for a while and then you slow down. But eventually, you're back to that mean, the average growth and hiring that the airlines have done historically over the last 15 plus years.
Right. The other good thing is they were saying wage increases are at 4.1%. And that is greater than inflation, which has gone down to, I don't know the exact number, it's about 3%. It's still bad. I mean, we don't want inflation, but at least the wages are keeping up. Moral of the story is one airline said this was going to be our busiest spring break ever. Doug, I think it's going to be our busiest summer ever. And hopefully that bodes well for fall because people are getting these jobs, they're getting more money. This is when they're buying their summer vacations. This is when they're putting in a deposit on a hotel for Christmas. I think it bodes well for the rest of the year.
Let's move on. Drew, we joke about some airline lounges, and we even have pet names for them, like the Loft, the E, Williams and Sonoma, the Plantation, and the View. But one of our favorites is what we call the Cook. It's a lounge in San Francisco that has nautical-themed material throughout it for some reason. So we named it after the famed explorer, Captain James Cook. We thought it was completely random to have a bunch of anchors and ship models in an airline lounge. I think you might have discovered its true identity. In fact, between you and me, I'm going to propose time to retire the name The Cook. I think that we need to rename it to its actual legacy, which is what?
The Clipper Club? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yes.
Well, okay, so I was really hoping for a closer connect. Well, so we'll talk about it, but you mentioned The View. What club do we call The View?
That's the one in Houston. I just named it the other day because you asked me what the name of the Houston club was with all the international departures.
Right.
Because it's got giant windows. I said, oh, we could call this The View.
Is that the E? That's the E
gates? It's the E. Yeah, the upstairs one in the E gates.
Okay. Yeah, because the SFO ones we have down. But in Newark, Denver, this is now Houston. All right. Because, you know, some of our contributors are actually using these. At least one of them uses the names that we use.
That's funny.
But then, okay, so back to this connection. I was at SFO, of course. What was it? Oh, it was on the way back because I had more time to walk around. It wasn't going to Hong Kong. I've never been to that SFO museum. There's a museum in the international terminal. Have you been to that?
I've never really had time. Maybe I'll try and go one of these days.
Yeah, it was closed for temporarily because they were putting in a new exhibit. But so I peered inside, and then one of the window displays has the Pan Am. It has Clipper Club and with a sailboat, with a sailing ship on it. And I was like, wait a minute, is this related to the Captain Cook Club that we go to? And I was hopeful, but Pan Am was never in that terminal that the company uses. So Pan Am was never in that. I was hoping that Pan Am used that club and we kept the furniture.
And that's why. Yeah.
But yeah, no, Pan Am had a nautical theme, so they called it the Clipper Club. Clippers are historically ships that plied the oceans, but they named their airplanes Clipper. So you'd have Clipper Empress of the Seas, Clipper America, Clipper... I remember Clipper Eagle was an L-10-11. I remember some of the 747s if I think back, but they had kind of a nautical theme, and their captains, their pilots, even wore white hats. Do you remember that?
Remember that, yes.
I think we stay with that. So maybe our company was fascinated with Pan Am and we were wannabe Pan Am because we didn't have a huge international network. And we thought, all right, when we do a club, let's make it look like Pan Am. I don't know. I'm trying to find the connection. Okay.
Well, part of it could have just been when Pan Am folded and our company assume some of the Pacific flying. I wonder if those relics were actually in one of the Clipper clubs.
That's
and they
right.
just moved it over to where we
are. Okay.
Sale or hey, we inherited it, all this stuff, what are we going to do with it? Oh, let's move it into our lounge.
Okay, right. So we were like, okay, we'll take five TriStars, and we'll take those plastic schooner ships that are in a plastic window.
We'll take the models and the anchors.
And we'll take the prince of the San Francisco Barbary Coast or whatever the hell that is at that club. I don't know. It was like, probably got it for free. It's like, just take it. I got a little advertisement from the Clipper Lounge or the Clipper Club. I don't know if you see it. It's so weird because Pan Am shut down in 1991, and looking at this card, you know, they have like an image of someone's Clipper Club card. It says member since 1989, and it is valid through 1992, and this poor dude may have gotten a lifetime membership for like, $1,500?
It says $1,500
which
for
he was
a lifetime
like,
membership.
You know, score, right? $1,500 lifetime. Not so much. Pan Am shut down in 1991, so he didn't even make it to the expiration of his card.
Poor guy. John Q. Member, that's his name. Poor guy.
And then I just want to note some things in the Clipper Club rules. I think that we should go back to these rules, Doug. One thing that I'm noticing is to maintain the exclusive atmosphere of the club, members are asked to wear neat travel attire in keeping with good taste, very casual and athletic attire, such as jogging suits, tank tops, shorts, bare feet, and the like are not permitted. Can we go back to that, please?
Please. Well, this brings us to another discussion and a new term that I'm going to coin right now, quote, recycled lounges. What I mean by this is airline clubs and lounges that are now used by different airlines that were not the original tenant. I had this in mind because I was thinking that the Cook, or now the Clipper Club, mm-hmm. was actually the Pan Am Club. Sadly, you proved that wrong. But Drew, can you think of any off the top of your head? I have quite a few that I've been to that are recycled lounges. Are there some that come to mind for you?
Yes. So now I am not Googling this, and some of these might be wrong, but I'm remembering the TWA Ambassadors Club. Would that be right?
Yes, that's what it was called.
Yeah. The Continental Presidents Club.
Mm-hmm.
There was...
I'm talking more, not just the lounge franchise itself, uh-huh. but like actual physical lounges, because I can tell you...
Yeah.
That a lot of our company's lounges were from the previous airline. And you right. walk in, and I went to those lounges when I was traveling with my dad for work. You walk into those now, they, aside from maybe new upholstery, it still is the same theme. And most airlines now are going to, like, when they build new lounges, they're, mm-hmm. they're trying to keep it very on brand, where it's like the same look and feel yeah. when you walk in. Some of these older lounges that they haven't redone yet, you walk in, and I could close my eyes and reopen them mm. and be back in a President's Club 20 years ago. And I'm in the same space, and I can just picture it used to be a previous lounge. A lot of Sky Clubs are like that, especially Minneapolis and Detroit. You walk in, they've got the fireplace, kind of the northern feel, almost like log cabin type thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting to walk in there and to think back on, well, I was here 20 years ago when it was a completely different airline,
uh-huh.
and now it's being recycled by current airlines. And it's not even after mergers. There are some, especially in Denver, you walk into, there's a Sky Club, there's a military USO,
mm-hmm.
and there's an Admirals Club in Denver that they occupy the space that used to be a President's Club. The entire huge thing
yeah.
has now been broken up into three different lounges, if you can call the USO a lounge.
Uh-huh.
But you walk in, and they still have the entry desk sitting in like this little hallway.
Mm.
All the bathrooms are shared space bathrooms for all the lounges because they broke it off into, they partitioned it into three. So in Denver, there is a space that used to be a President's Club that now is three different lounges,
uh-huh.
all broken up into smaller spaces.
I wasn't fortunate like you to have parents with club membership, so I never saw a club until I was a young adult. But I will tell you, just at Dulles Airport, they have one training room that has pillars in front of it, like some Roman Parthenon, or you know, you're entering some kind of Gothic temple. And that's this customer service training room. Doug, that used to be the TWA Ambassadors Club, hence the, you know, elaborate entrance. I'm like, all this for a training room? And then down at gate D26, I think, British Airways used to be in that CD concourse. And they used to have, I think it's called a galleries lounge. It definitely used to be a British Airways lounge or dining room for their first class passengers to eat their dinner. It is now a commute air break room. And it's nice in there. They don't have like fancy furniture and everything, but you could tell this was once a lounge.
Recycled. That's funny. If anyone else thinks of quote unquote recycled lounges, and I know that there are a lot after mergers and acquisitions, but if you can think of ones that are being used not by the merged company, for instance, it used to be a Northwest Sky Club or a Northwest World Club, and now it's a United Club or something. If you can think of those, let us know. All right, Drew, let's dive into this week's news, which thankfully isn't inundated with Boeing topics, minus this first one. What is it?
We asked this question several weeks ago. Actually, contributor Eric asked this question. How do airlines figure out how much they're due when these planes are grounded? Now we kind of have an answer. How much would airlines be compensated by Boeing for nearly 1 month of a MAX 9 grounding? So the Alaska Air Group publicly announced this week that Boeing paid them $160 million in the first quarter. This is equal to what Alaska expects its lost profits to be from that 737 grounding. Alaska expects additional compensation, though a number has not been announced. Alaska said in a statement, quote, although we did experience some book away following the accident and 737-9 MAX grounding, February and March both finished above our original pre-grounding expectations. So people forget very easily. I actually flew a MAX from Seattle to SFO. I did not flinch to fly that aircraft. It was a mm-hmm. great flight. Reuters reported this week that 737 production has fallen sharply due to increased oversight of the production process, which is directly impacting the airlines. And then Alaska said its capacity plans are now void, just like with a lot of airlines, Doug, due to the fact that it will receive fewer planes in the next 2 years than it expected. And United will even start offering unpaid leaves of absence to a select number of pilots who apply, also citing Boeing delivery delays.
This makes me wonder. I know that they can put a number on the lost compensation for that quarter. Can you really put a number on lost compensation for growth planes? Because an airline thinks that they're going to be growing and they end up not growing based on not getting the deliveries. I think we've said United expected 100 airplanes this year. They're not getting. Southwest has said about 70 in the next 2 years. Mm-hmm. Alaska. How do you put a number on that? How do you put a number on the lost potential revenue, not the lost revenue from the grounding? It's pretty easy to say, okay, we had 25 airplanes grounded. Multiply that by 4 flights a day, multiply it by $250 per passenger. It's pretty easy to say, yeah, it's $160 million, and that's what we're going to ask Boeing. How do you forecast that out into the future, not knowing what the deliveries are going to be? And can these airlines get compensation from Boeing for that lost time? And at the same time, Boeing is having to shell out millions, if not possibly billions of dollars because of everything that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Side note, it shows when you cut corners to cut costs, you end up possibly paying for it even more in the future. That's another discussion for another day. But Boeing needs this money to fix the program. And I also read an article this week saying that Boeing really just needs to launch the 797.
Right
now, I know it's not a great time. They don't have the cash flow, but they need to. It's almost like a company rebranding. ValueJet, they had that terrible crash in the Everglades in the late 90s. AirTran came out of that, and it was basically the same airline,
mm-hmm.
but people forgot about it because it was rebranded. Not saying that we're sweeping crap under the rug or anything here, but a brand new narrow-body airplane, the 797, to replace the 737 is exactly what is needed right now. And if Boeing is shelling out all this money for lost revenue, how are they going to be able to get that funding to be able to launch a new airplane? It's almost like a catch-22. It's this endless, I hate to call it a death spiral right now, but in a way it kind of is.
In the next couple of weeks, we're going to have a gentleman called Jeff Wise, who wrote an article which echoes exactly what we are talking about. And Doug, Boeing, for the longest time, has been about share price. Their goal, it seems like their goal was to raise the value of the company by raising its share price. So they make huge profits, of course. And then they would invest that not so much in research and development and the next generation of airplanes, buy back stock. I think what Boeing needs to do is not buy back stock, reinvest in the company, reinvest in new technology, research and development, namely the 797, as you said. And to be honest, for me as a person, as an investor and an aviation professional, to me that raises the value of Boeing, and their share price may actually go up higher if people know that they're organically
from investing in the company. People naturally then would look at it as that blue chip company that everyone wants to work for, everyone wants to be.
Well, and think about it, a lot of investors, they're not in it for quick cash. A lot of investors are in it for the long term. So I'm willing to invest in a company that I know has this product coming, and they're investing in that versus stock buybacks, because I know when that plane comes out, just like the 787, just like the 747, they took risks on all these planes, right? When it comes out, the profits are going to be crazy. It's going to be off the charts versus adding a kickstand and antennas and winglets and thingamajiggers to a 737 constantly. You know, it's time.
Oh, man, when I flew the 737, my least favorite thing was the thingamajiggers. I hated those.
It's like that, and what was it, the Beech 1900D? Do you remember that? It was a Beech 1900.
I do, when they threw the winglets and the weird, like, upside-down winglets on the horizontal stabilizer.
Well, yeah, I mean, you think of it as a trailer that continues to have ridiculous bump-outs, where eventually it's like, just buy a house. You know, keep adding parts to it.
All right, let's stop kicking Boeing while they're down. Our last story is a double go-around from something we talked about a couple years ago, bankruptcy restructuring. SAS said this week that a U.S. bankruptcy court approved its Chapter 11 reorganization plan nearly 2 years after initially filing for bankruptcy. As part of the plan, the Scandinavian airline will receive $1.2 billion in investments from several bidders, including the Danish government. The airline said that the restructuring will, quote, allow SAS to emerge from bankruptcy as a more competitive and financially stronger airline, unquote. Before I move on to the next bullets, I just want to add rebranding. We're talking about rebranding. We're talking about Boeing launching a new airplane. SAS is switching alliances. They're going to SkyTeam.
Yes.
I think that's part of, hey, we were moving past our lineage and history, even though they were a launch member, one of the first five of Star.
Yeah.
They're saying, we're going to emerge from bankruptcy a new company, or a rebranding in a way. We're going to change our alliance. We're going to change the way we do things. And hopefully that's like a fresh start for this company. We flew SAS. We really enjoyed it.
Yep.
We wish them all the best.
Yeah, and it's such a change, right? They've been, well, actually, you know, they were partners with Continental years ago. Because I remember flying Continental as a young adult. I was like 21 or 22, flying through Newark. All these SAS flights, and they were code-shared with Continental, and they were going to all, you know, all the major cities in Scandinavia. And then all of a sudden, they moved to the Star Alliance, and they've been there, what, for like 40 years, right?
And now, 25. Yeah, I think that Star, or 27. I think 97 was when it was launched. 97? So what is that, 27 years?
27 years, so a long time. So this is a huge change for them. And then we'll see what's, you know, the other shoe to drop hopefully will be ITA or ITA joining the Star Alliance, because this merger continues to proceed where Lufthansa is buying 40% or 41% of ITA.
And then separately, LATAM, who itself filed for bankruptcy in 2020, said this week that it plans to relist its shares on the New York Stock Exchange in the coming months. As a reminder, LATAM emerged from bankruptcy in 2022. When COVID hit in February, March 2020, we knew that it would send ripples through the entire industry. I think a lot of people expected it would be a decade. I know we've talked about this. I think that these are some of the final COVID pieces just working their way through the system.
Yep.
Hopefully by next year, things will be back to pretty much normal. Bankruptcies will be done, restructuring will be done, alliance changes will be done, and it's probably 5 years ahead of where everyone expected that we would be. But a lot of this still is those COVID ripples finally flushing from the system.
Yeah. And, you know, just for the listeners, SAS is based in Scandinavia. That's where their headquarters is. LATAM is based in South America. That's where their headquarters is. But they are both wanting to list on U.S. exchanges because they want to have access to that capital. So what happens is, if they're declaring bankruptcy, they declare bankruptcy here, even though their you know, their headquarters is in Scandinavia, because you want to be based in the U.S. so that you can sell your stock to all these people in the U.S. and around the world and have access to all that capital to grow your business, which you won't have if you're just in, I don't even know the name of the stock market in Copenhagen or Stockholm, but I'm sure it's not huge.
Drew, our main topic this week is one of our favorite things, aside from maybe lounges, which we just spent probably 15 minutes talking about.
At least.
This time we're talking about premium seats. According to a USA Today article, which cited Cirium data, U.S. airfares last year were 9% higher than 2019, though that is lower than the 19% overall inflation in the economy from 2019. While economy ticket prices are up, premium seats are actually less expensive. They're down 3% from 2019.
Yeah, and somewhat surprising news, ULCC, ultra-low-cost carrier airline Frontier, they're known for their cheap, no-frills tickets, and we've flown them, and we have experienced that. You buy a ticket for $65, and then you're waiting to board, and they're making an announcement asking...
You pay $65 for your backpack.
A backpack was as much, because I was afraid it would not fit in the sizer, and they seemed very stern about getting their bag charges. So anyway, I digress. It wasn't a good feeling. They're known for their cheap no-frills tickets, which I'm firsthand aware of. They announced this week that it is going to begin focusing on higher fare markets like Seattle and Detroit, and that will reduce supply in lower fare markets like Las Vegas and Florida. That's interesting, Doug. So, I mean, is that good or bad? Now they're going to be competing with the big boys.
They're going for yields. They're going for higher yields is what it sounds like.
But is there enough traffic? Carrier. Is there enough traffic to support them?
Oh, I'm sure there is. Seattle is a huge market, and Detroit is predominantly run by Delta, with Spirit, I think, being the second largest airline in that market.
Right.
There is a... I know Detroit has been struggling for 20 years economically, but it still is like 4 or 5 million people.
No, it's growing
in the entire metro area.
But have you heard this?
Detroit is growing. I mean, people write off Detroit and they compare it to like Akron or something, but Detroit is still a massive, massive market.
It's the headquarters of Ford and Boeing. Ford and General
Ford and
Motors.
G.
Yeah.
Or sorry, yeah, GM.
Right, so they're looking at Seattle, Detroit. So we'll give Delta 10 minutes to put hourly 767 400s between Seattle and Detroit. We'll see what happens.
Oh, no, I don't think it's just saying that they're going to fly between Detroit and Seattle. They're saying they're going to focus on that market, lots of different places.
Yeah, they'll reduce supply in lower fare markets like Las Vegas and Florida. In a more surprising news, and I like this part, the airline said it will increase its offering of premium seats, which in Frontier's case means extra legroom seats. CEO Barry Biffle, we haven't talked about in forever, Barry Biffle said that demand for premium seats has grown at double-digit rates. I like seeing these ULCC carriers adding some niceties, more room. Could we see a Frontier first class like in days past? I hope so.
This is a huge story. First of all, I added that first one just talking about how ticket fares are actually lower than what the overall inflation is. But we've seen it that the premium seats are filling up more because people are spending the money. Business travel is still like 75-80% of pre-COVID levels. Mm-hmm. It hasn't returned. We've done lots of stories and talked quite a bit about people shelling out their own money for the premium seats, as opposed to the business account paying for it. Frontier is trying to hop on this train of, we see that the premium seats are where people are wanting to gravitate toward. And when you have a ULCC who is known for $29 fares from Cedar Rapids to Denver, or from, I don't know, Savannah to Miami, something like that, and now you have these upsell, quote-unquote, premium seats. Yes, it's more legroom. But Frontier, if a ULCC is trying to capitalize on this boom in premium seats, that shows you how big of a market and how important it actually is. And I read in one of these articles that Delta said 40% of their revenue in 2023 was premium seat sales, which is the highest it has ever been in the company's history.
Yeah. And I can tell you, neither of us are very wealthy, but we also look for premium seats. Like, if it's a good offer, I'm going to pay that $200 for, you know, a 5-hour flight to California in a 737 if I can get a little bit more legroom. Well, maybe not 200, maybe 100 for Economy Plus. I would pay that. At first class, if it's like a couple hundred dollars, yes, 100%. So you're saying that the fares have gone down in business. So we are seeing that where it's more accessible and it's not $1,000. I'm not going to pay $1,000 to sit in first class Transcon, but 200, yeah, I probably would.
Well, and I know we've talked about this in the past. When I do my military training or trips and the government is paying for it, I don't get first class. I get economy. The government's paying for that ticket. So if I see a first class seat for $150-$200 and it's a long enough flight, I have not been afraid to shell out that money and pay for the upgrade in several instances that I can think of. And I think that's a lot of what we're seeing is you either buy the economy ticket, and then when you see the upsell, you're like, oh yeah, let's do it. Or people are just outright purchasing the premium seats to begin with.
Yeah.
My neighbors across the street, they're leaving for a Rhine River cruise tomorrow. They're flying to, I think, Amsterdam. And they were telling us, yeah, we couldn't pay for business. It was too expensive, but we're in premium economy. Mm-hmm. We shelled out the money for premium economy.
Yeah.
We're really looking forward to it.
This is not good for non-res, Doug, because remember when we
were... It's a... What do we say? It's a good problem to have, I guess.
Yeah, let me... A great example. I mean, this is great for most of our contributors who are not airline employees. Maybe we shouldn't even be telling people about this because they're going to be taking our seats. But Doug and I were Zed. We were on a Zed fare on Cathay SAS from Svo to Copenhagen. We saw 18 seats. So we stayed in the club. We're like happy, you know, fat, dumb, and happy, waiting to get our business class seats on SAS. We show up at the gate and they're like, all right, we have one business seat and one economy plus. And I was like, we're non-res, so we have to be nice. But I just want to be like, what? Yeah. They were doing the upsells. I don't know how much they were charging, but it was attractive enough.
They sold them at the gate?
Sold them at the gate.
Yeah.
I mean, 18 seats evaporated in less than 2 hours. So if you are not an airline employee, it's about you. It's not about us as non-revs. So look out for these deals.
Enjoy, enjoy the seat. Yes.
I mean, thankfully, there were at least two people on the flight from Sfo to Hong Kong that did not upgrade so that my mom and I could get those premium seats. So thank you. And actually, we don't really have any fire sales at our company. I mean, people get their upgrades, like they get to pay less miles, I think, if they wait until about 48 hours prior. But the day of, I see very little movement. So that is good. Please don't change that. All right, Doug, let's go to our ops topic that we missed last week. Let's read a few passages from the Good Book of Aviation. It's the 2024 FAR AIM. This time, let's talk about the commandments on airspeeds. Doug, let us read from the scripture, specifically 14 CFR, chapter 1, subchapter F, part 91, general operating and flight rules. Feel free to pontificate if you'd like.
This is 91, turn to your hymnals, 91.117, aircraft speed. A, unless otherwise authorized by the administrator, no person may operate an aircraft below 10,000 feet MSL, that's mean sea level, above sea level, at an indicated airspeed of more than 250 knots, which condensed for density and all that equates to roughly 288 miles per hour. Can I add something to this?
Yes, please.
A lot of times you can ask for, we call it free speed, or ATC will give you free speed. And I see it a lot taking off out of busy airspace where they don't want you putzing around at 250 knots, slowly leaving their airspace. They'll say, free speed, that's them telling us, speed up and get out of my airspace.
Wait, so it's below 250 feet?
Below
10,000 feet, sometimes they'll make an exception. It says that
technically it's only authorized by the administrator, which would be the FAA
Whitaker himself.
It is delegated down many times to air traffic control and to the crews. And for instance, on the 777-300, when we're going to Hong Kong, for instance, your flight to Hong Kong, the clean maneuvering speed is above 250 knots, meaning when you get your flaps and slats up, when you're taking off super heavy, it's around 260 knots. So we can't even comply with that 250 knot restriction. There are actually, in the FAR AIM, there are carve-outs and caveats where it basically says, unless operating restrictions prohibit that 250.
Okay.
So in that instance, if we fly 260, because that's our clean speed, technically that's illegal because that's an operating restriction.
Oh, right. Yeah, I think I did read something about that. If that is the operating parameters of the airplane, for safety, really, you can exceed that. All right, so 250, but they will tell you to go faster. And I guess the person who's telling you is a delegate of the administrator. So it does come from the FAA. It doesn't come from Dulles Airport Ops.
Moving on, B, unless otherwise authorized or required by ATC, no person may operate an aircraft at or below 2,500 feet above the surface within 4 nautical miles of the primary airport of a Class C or Class D airspace area at an indicated airspeed of more than 200 knots or 230 miles an hour. That, a lot of words, I'll sum it down. Within 4 miles of a C or D airport, no more than 200 knots. This paragraph B does not apply to any operations within a Class B airspace area. Such operations shall comply with paragraph A of this section. Class B airports are your major international airports. Class C are airports that you might think would be B, but they're actually not. We're talking here like Colorado Springs, like Sacramento.
I think Orange County is a Class C. Long Beach or Orange County, that might be a C.
Long Beach, I think Austin is a C. Those medium-sized to even large airports are Class C. It's your major international airports. San Francisco, Los Angeles, Seattle, Minneapolis. Those are all your Class Bs. Those have a whole lot more things going on there with like a 30-mile, you have to have Mode C when you're within 30 miles of a Class B airport.
Yep.
You have to talk to ATC before you even fly through that airspace. There's a lot going on with Class B.
Yeah, I mean, there's whole chapters of airspace rules and regulations and what they mean. Real quick, and fill in the blanks for me, Doug. So Class A airspace is above 18,000 feet on flight level 180. So that's easy to remember. And then Class E is from 10,000 to 1,800 feet, or over the ocean, it's 3,000 to 10,000 feet.
You said 1,800. There are a few cases around the U.S. where Class E could go down to like 1,200 feet.
Okay.
There are certain things. And then also when you're flying over, you may have read this, when you're flying over like national parks or national monuments or EPA protected areas. On the charts, there are lots of things where it may have a minimum altitude restriction where you actually cannot fly below, because they don't want someone flying at 1500 feet right over some national park and disrupting all of the people walking through that park and enjoying the nature. They want you to be a little bit more above it or higher than you normally would.
Okay. All right. So that's Class E. And then you have Class B, which are the big airports. So Washington Dulles, Kennedy, Newark, they have this circle. It's a circle. And then the farther you go out from the airport, it's higher up. And as you come in, it's down to the surface level. So if, at the airport itself.
Have you heard it called an upside down wedding cake?
Yep, that's what it looks like.
That's what we call it. Think of like a tiered wedding cake, but upside down. So the higher and farther you are out from the airport, the bigger that airspace is. And then it condenses down as you get closer to the airport itself.
Right. So when you're at the airport, it's from the surface. So your Class B airspace is from the surface up to 10,000. And, you know, it's an upside down wedding cake, right? So the layers are bigger as you go up. Doug, is that due to, like, when you're descending into that airspace, right, you're farther out, so the cake is bigger, right? So you're already in Class B airspace, even though you're further out, but you're higher.
Correct. It's also for departures as well, because we have the STARS, the standard arrivals, and the SIDS, the standard instrument departures. It's all based on trying to get the traffic in. For instance, there are several small airports under the wedding cake in San Francisco. We'll be at like 5,000 feet, 15 miles from the field on the ILS into 28 right or 28 left, and we see traffic below us. We see a little Cessna flying below us, but totally legal because they are low enough that they are outside of whatever that particular shelf that we're at that time. Mm-hmm. We're in the Class B airspace. They are not, even though we're literally right above them, because they're low enough below us.
Right.
And those pilots have to know, well, I can't climb above 2,500 feet because I would be in Class Bravo airspace. I have to get X number of miles out before I can start my climb.
Yeah, I'm just fascinated by this because I leave from this small airport, which is probably less than a class. I'm sure it's a Class D, right? It's a small airport with one runway. So I'm taking off. But we are within the Class Bravo airspace for BWI. So I see 757s and Southwest 737s right above me. So you think, should I be in this airspace? Yes, I can, because the chart tells me that Class B airspace for where I am, that wedding cake layer, is at 2,500 feet right by our little airport. So I'm fine if I stay below 2,500 feet. Now, as I move away over the Chesapeake to the east, I'm still under Class B airspace, but then it rises because that other level of the cake, which is bigger, that starts at 3,500 feet. So now I know I can climb to 3,500 feet to do my stall and slow flight training, and I'm still fine, even though I'm under the Class B airspace. And I'm in Class Echo airspace, I guess, because I'm far enough away from that. Anyway, I don't want to... It's all so much... I don't want to confuse our listeners. Even for me, it takes a while to like figure out, all right, you should see some of these sectional charts, and it is amazing how much information is on there. But once you keep looking at it, it makes sense. But initially, it's just overwhelming. Like, there's so much stuff on the chart, you can't even see the land. You know, there's so much writing on it and altitudes. Yeah,
very true. And then the final one, this is what I actually just mentioned. If the maximum safe airspeed for any particular operation is greater than the maximum speed prescribed in this section, the aircraft may be operated at that minimum speed.
Oh, that's exactly what you just said.
I talked about with our 777-300.
Okay, and that is the word of our administrator. Go in peace to love and serve aviation. I don't know, how do we end that? Doug, before we finish, speaking of speed, I understand you'll be going from still frigid 40-degree temperatures at a Cubs game in Chicago to the mid-70s in Maui the next day. How do you pack for this?
Actually, it's not the next day. I have a 24-hour layover in Denver before that. It's not easy, especially if I was just going to Chicago and was going to be walking around the hotel and not going to the game. It would be a little bit easier to pack for. Throw a pair of jeans in my bag. I've got a little fold-up down jacket, which is really warm, but it's like this big. Throw a pair of shorts, some flip-flops, and a swimsuit for Maui. I can do that. I can make it work. But because I'm going to the game, I'm having to put long johns in there. I'm having to put a compression shirt. bring an extra jacket. I've got gloves and a hat. The high in Chicago at the start of the game is going to be 44 degrees.
Oh, that's the high.
To put this into perspective, baseball is a summer sport. Everyone thinks flip-flops, t-shirts, shorts, eating a hot dog, drinking a beer in the sun, nice summer day. And when you think football, a lot of times you think like cold, very cold, snowy games because it's a more of a fall-winter sport.
Yep.
When our family went to the Green Bay Packers game back in November, the temperature at kickoff was warmer than what the first pitch temperature is supposed to be tomorrow at my Cubs game.
And that's tonight, right? Tonight you're going to Chicago.
Yeah.
And then you'll be
It's luckily it's a late afternoon start, so I'll get in, have some time to go to the hotel, take a nap, and then just leisurely head up to the stadium. I'm a lifelong Cubs fan. I've seen them play a lot of different places around the U.S. I have not been to Wrigley Field, which is where the Cubs play, in 18 years. This will be my first time at Wrigley, which, if you're a baseball fan, there are two stadiums that are like the mecca of the sport. You've got Wrigley Field in Chicago, and you've got Fenway in Boston. Those are both stadiums are over 100 years old. Of course, both of them, they've done millions of dollars of investment in updating the facilities. This is my first time at Wrigley since they put like $250 million into quote-unquote modernizing it, but still keeping the charm. So as soon as I got this trip on my schedule, I bought the ticket like that day.
Oh, nice. Wow, that's a nice coincidence that worked out. All right, so then Chicago, then Denver. Are you staying in Denver a night?
Yeah, 24 hours, I think, something like that. Okay. My college roommate lives in Denver, so I'm going to see him and his family. And then it's off to Maui, where, like you said, I'll be sitting on the beach drinking a Mai Tai, listening to some steel drum band while everyone else is staring at the sun or lack of the sun. I'll have my feet kicked up and be enjoying the islands.
Okay, that's awesome. All right, so Doug is here today, gone to Maui. All right.
that could be the name of the episode. That's good.
There you go.
All right, well, to our friends and contributors, this podcast is your show, so go on our website, nexttripnetwork.com. Let us know what's on your mind so we can talk about it or give us your feedback. You can also follow us on Instagram or Threads at Next Trip Podcast. Please tell your friends about us so we can reach more people who love aviation and travel.
We love the comments that we get from our contributors, so keep sending us that. But also think about just calling our Google Voice. Like, if instead of emailing a comment, just call the Google Voice. It's faster than writing an email. You can just speak to us, and we can air your voice so that you are literally part of the podcast. However, now that number is 872-529-5620. When you're calling from the U.S. And then if you're calling from abroad, use country code 001 or plus 1. Thanks to all of our friends and contributors for your support and for joining the conversation. We'll see you next week. And in the meantime, stay aviation tough.
This has been the Next Trip Podcast. Visit nexttripnetwork.com for information about previous episodes, trip reviews, aviation photos, and other aviation-related content. This is your show, so search for The Next Trip on Twitter and let Doug and Drew know what you want to talk about. Not on Twitter? You can also email them at nexttrip.podcast@gmail.com. Please consider leaving a review wherever you download your podcasts. It will help other listeners like you discover this show.
All right, so, Doug, before we spinach.